From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We are keeping our eye on the White House and President Trump's health, and if anything changes there, we will let you know. Yesterday, Trump climbed the White House stairs, dramatically removed his mask, and told the country not to let COVID dominate you. The president seemed defiantly oblivious to the fact that the pandemic is indeed dominating this country. The impact is everywhere. I mean, just think of the millions of families and educators who were watching that moment at the same time their kids are trying to get an education via a small laptop on the kitchen table. That is reality right now, and it has been since last March in thousands of school districts across the country. So today, we want to talk about what's happened in K-12 education this year. 6 months ago, we actually had this remarkable conversation with a couple of education professors at the University of Georgia who told us, back then, that there could be something positive that comes out of the giant pause that had to come when schools shut down.
I think what we see happening is that our education system itself is decompressing and it's revealing itself to us.
Basically, in crisis comes opportunity. An opportunity to rethink high-stakes testing, to rethink how schools reach and raise up the most vulnerable students, to rethink what education for the 21st century ought to look like.
We get a chance to sit back and really ask ourselves, what is the most important thing that we need to be doing right now? And what might we carry with us outside of this crisis?
Well, here we are, half a year later, still in the crisis, and school is back in session. So what is happening on screens and in classrooms?
I'm exhausted. I think it's a really, really tiring way to teach. For anyone who's been in Zoom meetings all day, it's like that, only sort of crossed with some kind of circus performing or something is all I can, like you're trying to entertain the children.
So I have a third grader, he's 8 years old, and he's currently in school, and he's online for like 4 or 5 hours a day. So I have to switch between teaching my class. You know, when my students get a break, I run and go check on my son, and then I come right back to my students. So I have to be going back and forth. It's very difficult.
It's twice as much work to try to get lessons prepared because we have to be ready for if this website's not working, if something's going to crash. Like this week, Schoology was crashing and Microsoft was crashing and Outlook was crashing. So you have to have all these backup plans.
I have a tweet that I tweeted on Twitter after the third week of school, I think. It was in the middle of September, maybe the fourth week of school. And I said, this is not sustainable. And that's all I put in the tweet. Well, this week I was like, I think I should retweet this again. And maybe I'll retweet this every week and keep going.
Stories from teachers in Texas, Massachusetts, and Georgia. Well, Hillary Hughes and Stephanie Jones, you are the two University of Georgia professors who raised the possibility for change in American education back in the spring, and I loved that conversation, and I'm so glad you could join us on the show again. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Meghna.
So, 6 months later, what do you two see around you in terms of K-12 education in the United States?
Boy.
It's a lot of chaos, isn't it? It's a lot of chaos and uncertainty. And in some cases, I think we both would say that we see really exciting pockets of hopefulness and amazing possibilities for change. And then a lot of places trying to go back to pre-pandemic schooling, which is impossible.
Right. Yes. I think we could sum it up with like forced resiliency and teacher exploitation and edutainment, like the one teacher said that you played the clip from. It's a lot of things that are not okay. And like Stephanie said, with pockets of really good things happening, but not enough.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about those pockets of good things a little later in this hour, because I still believe that in every even terrible crisis, there is some opportunity there. But I think let's hear a little bit more from teachers about how about the challenges that they're facing right now. For example, you're about to hear from Shana V. White, who teaches middle school computer science in Metro Atlanta. And she told us she has no choice but to teach in person this fall. She didn't have the choice. And now she's teaching simultaneously in person and online and remote students. And here's what it's been like.
To be a teacher, to have taught so long, and you almost just see the demise of the public school education system happening on your watch is just demoralizing, because there's nothing you can do. You can do the best you can in your classroom, and you can positively impact. I can positively impact the 200 plus kids I have, but there's thousands of other kids that are worse off than the kids that are in my classes, even in the same building. There's some kids that, like, their teachers don't talk to them. They don't let them talk at all. They've kicked them out of Zooms. They over-police them.
So that's Shana V. White in Metro Atlanta. And Hillary Hughes, let me just get a quick response from you about when Shana's saying that she is seeing in her eyes what she believes is the demise of public school education happening on her watch, public school education, I should say, respond to that.
I mean, it's hard to not agree because because what she said, what you said, everyone we've talked to all over the country, that they're all doing everything they can, and it's on the hamster wheel, and teachers don't have control. Teachers are being forced to, like she said, go to school in person and teach to their online class and their face-to-face class. And administrators are trying to protect their teachers and their students and their staff and their families. But the districts are telling the administrators certain things that they have to do. And people just didn't take the time, some, to think about how this could have been differently. And so they're in the moment right now trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And they had months to do something different, which is not even a lot of time. And so then things are just kind of falling apart for at least the educators.
Yeah. So folks listening out there, parents, family members, teachers, administrators, hop over to Twitter or Facebook if you have a second. We're at On Point Radio, and let us know what you think about what's happening, the reality check that's going on right now in K-12 education in this country. Now, Stephanie Jones, the thing that I found actually surprisingly inspiring when we talked to the two of you early in the pandemic was this idea that the American K-12 education system was forced to take this pause, right, when schools shut down. It was a decompression is what you called it, a decompression of the system, of the education system in this country. So there was opportunity there. Help us understand a little bit what it is about the system of education in the United States that perhaps made it not so able to take advantage of the opportunity. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not just like teachers' fault. It's no one's fault here, but there's a system that isn't really primed for change, even when the opportunity is given to it. And why is that?
Yeah, absolutely. So interesting enough, I do think that we are still in the decompression and we're in a deflated stage. And someone's trying to pump some air into some balloons and get something going again. But unfortunately, we're relying on a narrative that technology is our savior. And big tech companies started banging on school doors as soon as this pandemic hit. We have tech giants across the country and tech moguls saying, why do we even have school buildings anymore? We can do all of this remotely. So folks in the technological industries have convinced some people that they can save public education, and it's just not true. So there's a sense that many schools have just picked up this narrative and taken off, and lots of teachers and lots of schools have not only purchased new hardware, software, professional learning, apps, they've gotten these things into their students' hands, but that is not what is going to save public education. So what they did, and this is what I think your question is really about, what they did is they looked to the market for an answer. Instead of looking to teachers and children and young people and people who understand learning and teaching and what needs to be in place. And that's very typical to look to the market, look to businesses.
It's typical for education to look to the market?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So that's how we got into this testing mess that we're in. The testing industry is a $1 billion industry. And when politicians didn't know how to hold schools accountable, then they went to the testing industry. So the testing industry creates the tests and they create the curriculum and they sell it for millions and millions and millions of dollars to school systems. And then teachers have to implement that. So that's been going on at least for 20, 25 years.
Okay, well, Stephanie Jones and Hillary Hughes, stand by for just a moment. We're getting a reality check on where K through 12 education is in this country right now, the seventh, eighth month we're into this pandemic, and if there's still an opportunity here, an opportunity to really rethink education for the 21st century. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we are talking about the reality on the ground, in homes and in classrooms, regarding K through 12 education in the United States. And we've returned to speaking with two professors, education professors from the University of Georgia, whom at the beginning of the pandemic suggested that there was the possibility, with the pause that came with school shutdowns across this country, to really rethink, modernize education in this country. So we're asking if that's happened, and if it hasn't, what's stopping it from happening? So I'm joined today by Stephanie Jones and Hillary Hughes. They are professors of education at the University of Georgia. And before the break, we were talking about technology being a central part of the story right now. Hillary and Stephanie, I just want to play for you a moment from another teacher that we spoke to. This is Marsha Murray Bunsey, who teaches high school English in Atlanta. She teaches students who have struggled in traditional school settings, and she says that when it comes to online learning, people are worrying about the wrong thing.
It's just a logistic issue. You know, it's not education, right? Kids are home. Parents have to be home. Kids need to be supervised, right? And I think what needs to happen, or the first thing that needs to happen, is let's differentiate the difference between education and schooling. Schooling has become problematic thus far with the pandemic. No one has addressed education. We haven't spoke about education in this country. All we talk about is schooling. What schooling does, it creates division. It creates a lot of division. Education can help us unify, right, and create equitable experiences.
That's Marsha Murray Bunsey from Atlanta. Hillary, respond to that about the difference between focusing on schooling versus focusing on education, and what opportunity are we missing right now by not differentiating between the two?
I mean, that's interesting. I'm glad that Marcia brought that up. I think I would say that that both education and schooling, both are very inequitable. And the opportunities we do have are, like we talked about with you 6 months ago, we would have to really, really undo a whole history of structures that are in place that are pretty oppressive and inequitable, incredibly oppressive and inequitable. And the education part also has been inequitable. And so the structures of buildings, the structures of how we set up classes and how we think about time and all of those structures, those are inequitable. How we draw lines and who gets money and what schools, what districts get money and who doesn't. All of those practices are inequitable. I mean, it's an amalgamation of everything that that only allows for some kids in our country, mostly white, middle and upper middle class, to receive different kinds of access. And so the education part, though, that comes with those structures. And so if you have access and you have funding and you have materials and all of the things, then, and you have teachers who they can choose their own professional learning opportunities, and they're constantly, you know, living as inquirers and strengthening their practices and their curriculum and their relationships with their students. So there's so much that's wrong, that's inequitable, that I would say it's and both.
Mm-hmm. Well, the issue of exacerbated inequities in education came up over and over again with the teachers that we talked with mm-hmm. over the past several days. So I just want to let you hear from Olivia Udovic, kindergarten teacher in Oakland, California, and she teaches in a dual immersion program, half the day in Spanish, the other half in English. And she told us that she thinks the kids that she serves and the families she serves have long been forgotten.
Unfortunately, because of the lack of action, quite frankly, on behalf of especially our federal government, but even on the local or state level, even in Democratic states, in communities like East Oakland, where I live and work, our community's been neglected for generations, and now people here are really struggling even more than they usually do, and it's going to be a long time before it's safe for people to go back in the classroom. And that's not the fault of these 5-year-olds or their parents or their teachers. But they're the ones that are paying the price.
That's Olivia Udovic, who teaches kindergarten in Oakland, California. Stephanie, I'm going to come back to this question over and over again with the both of you. And forgive me, sometimes when I just I feel like Sisyphus a little, but maybe that's because there is no clear answer. But I'm just really trying to understand, what is it about how education works in America right now that prevented or made it hard to make changes, even some changes? Like, we can't hope for a dramatic reconfiguration of education overnight. Mm-hmm. But it seems like one of the stories of public education in the United States is that actually change is hard. It comes by very hard. Sometimes it has to be forced in the courts. You know what I mean? So is there something fundamental about how this country views public education that makes it a world that it is harder to evolve?
Well, I really think that Marcia hit on something when she said that this is about logistics and just kind of getting kids distracted so that, quote, the economy can get back to work. And that second part is my addition. So I think that another thing that we're seeing is we have exposed a really huge unpopular truth that the underpaid work of mostly women in childcare and in education has become the key to the running of this country's economy. And that unpaid and underpaid labor has been called upon to get back to work no matter what those conditions will be, so that families can get back to work, quote. I think one of the White House officials over the summer said our human capital stock is ready to get back to work. Well, in order for folks to get back to work, then children need to be, quote, distracted or supervised. And maybe some people think that this, especially these kinds of technology solutions, will keep them distracted for a while.
Okay.
So the question of why, like why education? And that's all upside down right now.
Okay. So
why is not, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think you're getting to something, well, lots of things important there, but because I have the sense that in many, many districts across the country, because of the very pressures that you're talking about, there was the push to get back to, quote unquote, as normal as possible, right? Like just at this point in time, just recreating a semblance of the school day, even if it's through a computer at home, seems to actually be, you know, kind of a win in the middle of this pandemic. And that even that was success now, rather than kind of being more ambitious and rethinking what the school day should be. Am I wrong on that?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we saw in March and April and May, the nation came together and heralded teachers as heroes for what they did to improvise and meet everyone's needs when we shut down across the states and different states in our country. And those same teachers have been attacked since July because they've been questioning the safety of being back in school or the validity or the effectiveness of doing online schooling. So, I do think that it's just about let's get kids distracted and supervised somehow so that the adult folks that we need in the workplace can get back to work. Hillary? And that's the wrong question.
Yeah, Hillary, jump in here. What do you think?
I mean, I'm just thinking, I mean, our president said that. I mean, he was, you know, tweeting that we have to get back to work. And yes, schools are childcare. And I mean, I've heard teachers constantly for months saying, I mean, we understand that people have to get back to work, but this is not, but what about the health and well-being of our students? What about the health and well-being of us? So people, and all of these decisions people are making, like Stephanie said earlier, teachers and students and families were not asked to contribute to what we could have done differently. And when you live in a society that revolves around capital, then it's all about the market and capitalism. Mm. And so that is what we are seeing. I mean, that, like Stephanie said, that is what is happening, is people are under pressure. I talked to some administrators and some teachers who talk about districts pressuring them all over the country to get things ready. We've got to get kids back in. We've got to get normalcy, but it's not normal. Nothing that's happening when people are face to face right now with masks 6 feet apart and teachers are, I talked to a teacher in Colorado who is teaching all the subjects. She has, you know, the small group of students all day. She's in a dual language school as well. And for 2 weeks, she has the same group of students and they teach in English, and she teaches every single content area, all the specials, music, PE, art. And then she's sanitizing the whole room in between any break that they have. It's insanity. Mm. And it's all about, I mean, how I see it, and I think Stephanie would agree, it's about capitalism. It's about, we have to get the economy going. And so this is what the only solution we can come up with is, teachers, you need to do this.
Well, I hear your critique of capitalism there. And at the same time, the the urgency that many communities feel to actually get their economies going back again is also very real, given the economic impact of the shutdown. I mean, so this takes us to an area of conversation about, again, the consistent failures of leadership at the highest levels of this country. Over and over again, I keep saying this did not have to happen. But I want to as we navigate through the reasons why both of you who have been watching education so closely do feel somewhat demoralized, as we navigate through those reasons, you also talked about some glimmers of hope. So I want to turn to one of those glimmers, okay? And let's shift our focus for a moment to Seattle, Washington, where Chandra Hampson joins us. She's a member of the Seattle School Board, represents District 3 there, and she was elected to a 4-year term on the Seattle School Board in November 2019. Chandra, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Now, the Seattle schools are piloting an interesting program with kindergarten and first graders. Is that right?
Well, actually, it's open to all grades.
Okay.
And it's building-led. But this week, applications will be going out, it's a very simple application for whether it's a teacher, a grade band, or a building that wants to run an outdoor education pilot as part of their education delivery during this quarter or semester.
So outdoor education, Chandra, what does that mean?
Well, it's become a bit of a loaded term, unfortunately, just related to the discussion prior. When we realized that we were going to be going back in a primarily, almost exclusively remote environment, we were also aware as a school board, and I will say that I'm relatively new, as are many of my other school board members, and we believe we represent a significant shift in terms of how we approach the business of education. And I use that play on words intentionally with the prior conversation. But that we needed to focus on those students and families that we knew that have been forgotten, like the students in East Oakland in the dual language program, and that we needed to focus not on what we've done before, but how do we attend to their wellness? How do we attend to their intellectual health during this period? How do we stay connected to them? And we knew that there was likely very few ways that was going to happen. And yet we did have this very important piece of legislation that had been passed at the state level that someone had snuck in that basically said that as long as we were sticking with our it doesn't really matter the curriculum, but that we could, in fact, teach outside. And, in fact, the Department of Health had kind of sketched out some guidelines for doing some outdoor learning. And
can I just jump in here? Because I'm still not exactly clear on what outdoor learning in this context means. Is it just like the classes, literally the kids come together and they have class outside? Or is it that there are places around Seattle that go to and the learning happens in the context of those places?
It's what we, in terms of the pilot, what we have said is it's as simple as you can possibly make it to foster that connection with students, amongst students and with their teacher, whether it's on the playground, whether they go for a walk, whether it's a walking science class, which is actually already a common practice. But it's basically that thing is happening outside. So it could be just on the playground. It could be in a neighboring park. And it could be something that happens once a week. It could be something that happens every day. It is determined by because the last thing that we need to do right now is add additional stress to our teachers and administrators. And we wanted this, very intentionally wanted this to be something that provides hope to kids, to families, to teachers, and to administrators.
And is there an appetite? Is there an appetite for this in the district?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. We have been getting calls. People are chomping at the bit. And when I say people, I mean the broader school community and our partners. We have some fantastic partners that work already with our schools in supporting them and doing learning outside and connecting learning to what is going on in your environment around you. And we also felt what more critical time to, as we have demonstrated as a board in our support for our students who are involved in the climate strike, what better way or better time to connect students to the environment around them that is suffering? You know, we've been choked by wildfires, and these are our climate activists and our climate justice warriors for this next generation. And so we need to see that learning that they're doing connected to what's going on around them, especially in communities where they suffer adverse effects.
Well, yeah, Chandra Hampson, a member of the Seattle School Board representing the 3rd District there, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Stephanie Jones and Hillary Hughes, stand by. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, it'll be Wednesday, and that means another round of our Voter Roundtable series. And we will be talking with younger, first-time voters, like 19-year-old Brian Guevara from Greensboro, North Carolina.
We want to know what's real. We want to know what's false. And we don't really care for being around the bush.
Well, if you turned 18 in the past couple of years and this is your first time voting in a presidential election, how do you feel about casting that ballot? What do you make of the political system that you're now participating in? And what issues do you wish older Americans would care more about? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 for tomorrow's Voter Roundtable. Today, we are getting a reality check about K-12 education in this country. And I'm joined today by two professors of education at the University of Georgia, Stephanie Jones and Hillary Hughes. And before we move on to sort of some of the deeper questions about what opportunities we have now, Hillary and Stephanie, I just wanted you to respond to what we heard from Chandra Hampson in Seattle about efforts there to expand a little bit into outdoor education. Stephanie, what do you think of the pilot program that they're launching there?
I love their pilot program. And in addition to the outdoor education and being in public spaces and community spaces, connecting children to the place where they live and their community, all of those things are just so incredibly positive. We know that the more time that children and teenagers spend on the screen, the higher levels of depression and anxiety and lower levels of safe risk taking. We know that the more time that children and youth spend outside, that they take safer, their risk taking is still very safe, and they learn to take risks, and their depression and anxiety decreases significantly. They feel a sense of connection to their spaces and to the other people.
Can I just say though, it sounds exciting. It also does not sound revolutionary, to be frank, right? I mean, we're talking about just like having class outside so kids can have fresh air.
No, not exactly. So I was at the board meeting for the Seattle proposal. that they voted on in late summer. And there are teachers in Seattle that are so committed to understanding the indigenous lands there, understanding the ecology of the natural spaces in and around Seattle, to really digging into the history of how the city grew the way that it did, and their divisions and their communities. So that's very different from just holding class outside.
Okay. So the fact that I had to go through a long board process, I'm just going to speak here, frankly, as a journalist / parent. Is that not a source of part of the frustration that to do this, which makes so much sense, connecting students to their community in this way, it's a lot of work, bureaucratic work in the world of education to even sort of claw your way towards that?
Yeah, I agree. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. I think... even from the very beginning, when Hillary and I were on several months ago, I think one of the points we were trying to make is follow the lead of young people and teachers. Mm-hmm. And they will know what the possible solutions are. So we have teachers who are so talented and so passionate and so committed, and they have ideas for how they can do this even in a pandemic. And they can make education even better than it was pre-pandemic. So we need to just give them some autonomy, ask them what they want to do, and open up these rigid structures and let them go be creative. And then others, you know, Hillary and I are researchers, then let some researchers document that and show folks what happens when you follow teachers and young people.
Well, we have been getting a ton. You can imagine how much feedback we've been getting about this on social media.
It's great.
Dori Scheiber's our On Point producer, who's monitoring the ever vivacious conversation that happens on social media with On Point. And what are some folks saying, Dori?
Yeah, a lot of people are expressing just frustration, exasperation with this school year so far. Lara says, to recognize that we can't get through the same amount of material this year and adjust for that. Homework should be rare. Kids are exhausted after a day of Zoom. The education system, I think, will be adjusting for a decade at all levels. Daniel Atkins told us on Facebook, public education today is like a deer in the headlights. The valiant, underpaid teachers are the anxious eyes being traumatized by the paralyzed body of a politics that only knows money without any capacity for supporting these creative solutions.
Okay. Wow. So that's just a taste of what's happening on social media. Mm-hmm. Dori, thank you for that. So Hillary and Stephanie, I want to come back to something that we talked about a little earlier, because it's one of the sort of foundational issues in education in this country. And that has to do with equity. So we actually talked with one North Carolina middle school teacher who recently really wanted a firsthand look at what his students' realities are.
If you are afraid to travel and to go into the neighborhoods that your students are from, I need you to reevaluate some things.
And that's Stephen Gupton. He teaches health science at the James E. Shepherd IB Magnet Middle School in Durham, North Carolina. And students are not back on campus there. They're learning remotely. And some of his students were not showing up for those remote classes. So last week, Stephen decided to visit his students at their homes to make sure they're okay.
So my name is Stephen Gupton. I am a middle school health science educator for Durham Public Schools out of North Carolina. I am one of the proudest educators in the state of North Carolina. That's who I am. As the son of an incarcerated male serving a 37-year sentence, I make sure that I share that in my classroom with my students, especially students who look like me. I want them to know that behind the suits and the ties, that I'm still human, just like they are. Once they find out that you trust them, that you absolutely love them, and I tell people all the time, you can argue with me if you want to, but you can't teach a child you don't love. And once they find out that you're human, that you love them, and that you're real, then they don't want to let you down. So they want to be there. And as you can tell, if mine don't show up, I knock on doors. When we noticed that we had students not showing up or not attending class or really late to class each day, a lot of assignments missing, you know, of course I was worried about them doing some work, but I'm also more concerned about their well-being. So a coworker and I, we were working on our campus on Wednesday. So we're there and we decided to do home visits. It was nothing planned. We were like, you know what? These kids aren't showing up. Let's create a list. Let's figure out what's going on. And we showed up to some homes. We knocked on some doors. And I can't even explain how big the smiles were. So what we did was had students and families come outside. And we just talked and had some conversations. Like one of my students, he was having issues with connection. He couldn't get his laptop to connect to the internet. And we sat there for a few minutes. And the other teacher and I actually took about 10 to 15 minutes to troubleshoot the situation. And while we were doing that, we were talking about his interest, football, basketball. A lot of the conversations we had were not education related. We just wanted to make sure that we were laying eyes on these students and that they were okay. It's like I had a seventh grader who was home. He was the oldest of four children. So if I have one student like that, how many other students do I have like that? So how do I expect him to sit and complete assignments that close at a certain time or that's due at a certain date if he is the oldest person at home Monday through Friday while mom and dad are working, tending to the other three children that are younger than he is, right? So, you know, you have to be a bit lenient. You have to take into account all of the circumstances and situations that these students are actually in. You know, I'm sitting here now at my dining room table and it's quiet. Right. My dog is beside me and he's on his best behavior. So you don't hear him, but it's quiet in here. And I keep going back to that. I have a quiet space to work. Every child does not have that. So if every child doesn't have a quiet space, then every child may not have food. We have to think about whether or not they have heat now that is getting cold. If they had air conditioning during the year, do they have washer and dryer? Do they have a place to lay their head at night? Or are they sleeping on the floor? Are they sleeping on a couch? Is it three or four of them sleeping on a couch? Is there alcoholism, opioid overdoses going on in that house? You know, we have to think about those things. And that goes across racial lines, right? That is not a Black neighborhood. That is not a white neighborhood. That is not marginalized communities. And that is not suburbs with the gated community. That's every child. If there were inequalities and if marginalized children were not served properly in a school building, then I can promise you that has multiplied with them sitting at home and us talking to them through a screen. The students who were the high flyers and I hate to say, I'm going to air quote, you know, had the ideal lifestyle. They had overhead light at home to work by, you know, when they were completing homework. They had food in the pantry. They had parents at home that were able to provide certain things that other ones couldn't. They're fine. The same students that we were not able to serve in a building are the same students that are hurting now, and they're hurting even more.
Stephen Gupton teaches health science at the James E. Shepherd IB Magnet Middle School in Durham, North Carolina. Now, Hillary and Stephanie, just respond to what you heard Stephen say there. There's sort of truths about America as a nation that are distilled in the classroom. And that has not changed. It's been made even worse in this pandemic. So where does that leave teachers?
I'm going to let Stephanie take that one. Okay. I got to calm down over here a little bit.
You know, that just listening to Stephen Gumptum was just really moving. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Why are we opening, quote, schooling the way that we were before? And if it really is to meet the needs of children and young people and families, then we've gone about it the entirely wrong way. We've known, you know, we have 40 years of research on how effective home visits are in education. We know, we have researchers who have studied what they call funds of knowledge. starting in the 1980s, and what teachers can learn and do with their curriculum when they visit the homes of their students and they see the richness and the strength and the resilience and the needs of children and families in their communities. We educators know how to do this. And across the country, teacher education programs are still teaching their students who will be educators. They're still teaching them to do these things, but then they're hired into systems that just keep them in buildings and don't give them the autonomy and freedom to do this.
Hillary, I do want to hear from you because, you know, maybe one of the big lessons of this moment is that I don't want to say that it's not time for calm, but it's time for real talk. Like, what do you think? Give me the real talk right now.
I mean, that was beautiful and moving. And, you know, this is the work. This is our work. I spend my days undoing, and I'm gonna go real talk here, Meghna. It's a school system that has historically been built out of whiteness and the haves and the have-nots, and it's created. We have a system that has, you know, you either get to succeed or you don't, and if you're gonna succeed, you have to do these things, and then we have this meritocracy bootstrap narrative that's never left our education system. Well, if you work really hard, you can get out of that neighborhood. And that's not, I'm just going to try not to cuss here. That's a myth. And there's plenty of research and plenty of years and years of research that says that that's a myth, but we continue to perpetuate this, you know, if you work really hard, if we just catch you up, if you are from a wage poor family, or you are in a Title I school, let's not give you those opportunities where you're doing incredibly innovative student-centered curriculum based on students' interests and having kids out in the community and thinking about community issues and having interdisciplinary curriculum. Let's instead give you these programs that we're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on from our title money to teach kids to catch you up. And there's the breakdown of inequity.
Yeah. We have 1 minute to go. And we took a small bite out of a huge topic. So we'll have you back again, okay? What I wonder is that, okay, maybe we didn't have the transformational change that we wished for, but the pandemic is still going. It's forcing changes here and there in little ways on the ground level every day in classrooms, in homes, in schools and districts. So I think maybe something will continue to happen. So if we have you back, we just have 30 seconds, Hillary and Stephanie, so quickly. When we have you back in 6 months, what do you hope that we are talking about at that time? Stephanie?
Oh, I think in 6 months, schools will be planning outdoor, real integrated curriculum.
Okay.
We're going to be heading into the spring, and that's what we need.
And Hillary, what do you hope we're talking about education in 6 months?
Anything different than what we're doing now, Meghna.
Well, Hillary Hughes is an associate professor and graduate coordinator at the Department of Educational Theory and Practice at the University of Georgia. Thank you, Hillary, so much.
Thank you.
And Stephanie Jones, a professor in the Department of Educational Theory and Practice at the University of Georgia. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna. This has been great.
And they are both co-directors of the Red Clay Writing Project. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.